Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you for getting in touch recently. I'm going to be doing some shout-outs, mentioning some of your emails in a moment. Sadly, because of time constraints, I haven't had a chance to make notes on all of your emails, but do believe me that I've seen each and every one of them, and I will be doing a longer segment of shout-outs in a future show. The weather. I know some of you don't like me talking about the weather, so zone out for a minute just while I mention what's been happening here. We had a thing called Storm Barney that hit the UK very badly, and the back end of it hit us yesterday, Saturday. So when I drove home from Berkshire to my home in southwest London yesterday on the motorway, my car was pushed all over the road by the wind. It was quite extraordinary, and we had a day of rain and storms and grey, gunmetal grey skies. Horrible day. This morning I wake up to two things. It's ice cold. I think it was something like -4, -5 Celsius overnight, well below freezing point. And I also woke up to find that my right ear, regular listeners to The Unexplained will know that I've had some hearing problems after a virus and some other difficulties a few years ago left me with tinnitus. This morning, my right ear is very, very dull. And so I've lost a lot of high frequencies in the right ear. I think it might be something to do with the change in atmospheric pressure. So if I don't sound quite like myself today, that's the reason for that. I'm doing this on one ear, and we'll get through. But any thoughts and suggestions about that, gratefully received. If you want to connect with me, contact the show, you can do that through the website, theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv, and the website designed, created, maintained and honed by Adam Cornwell from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. The world is a very worrying place in the 7 days after the terror attack in Paris claimed the lives of close on 130 people, left scores of others still in hospital as I say these words. Nobody can quite compute the enormity of this. And of course, it's put capitals around the world, and here in Europe particularly, on pretty high alert. In Brussels, Belgium yesterday, which has been the crucible of some of this, it appears some of the people involved in the Paris thing had links with Brussels. Brussels was in lockdown yesterday. People were advised not to go to shopping malls and do their normal things, avoid stations if they could. And that country was very quiet yesterday. A lot of people asking, what have we come to when we are forced to do things like this? But, you know, every capital city now, every city, I would say, is concerned. London certainly very much a high security area at the moment, but life has to go on. Which brings me to the subject of the last show that I did, and that is mentioned by quite a few emailers. I'm just going to pick a couple. Somebody, I had a few emails that were under pseudonyms. This is from somebody calling themselves Anna Graham, who says, as somebody interested in the alternative viewpoint, I was surprised to hear you taking the Paris events at face value. The attack is part of a pattern of manipulation and war on terror. Well, okay, Anna, but I think at the moment we just have to try and take in the events as they stand. I think the conspiracy theories and all the rest of it, when they are properly formulated, can come later. But for right now, I think, certainly at a distance of 24 hours from the events in Paris, the best thing I could have done was to find somebody that you hadn't heard talking about this, somebody who is an expert on Islamic politics around the world, to discuss it. And I think he put some very succinct and very on-the-money arguments about it all. But of course, the conspiracy viewpoints will come in at a later date, and we will cover those. I do not think, and I think a lot of people might agree with me, that at the moment, that's just not appropriate. Especially here in Europe, where we're in mourning for those people who died in that beautiful city. Tilly Cat says, regarding the sickening events in France and the Muslim intel guy, I guess you're talking about the professor who was on What a Crock and various views of that sort. I understand what you're saying, Tilly Cat, but I hope you get where I'm coming from, all of this. Karen, regular listener in Ontario, Canada, says, I have my own suspicions that there is something amiss with who and what the government tells us ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever actually is. But the fact is that we're being herded like sheep into some language-controlled, behavior-controlled, totalitarian climate. And as long as I can do so, I will resist this. John Ziegler, nice email from you, John, on a completely different topic. An expat having recently relocated from New York City to southern Italy says, once renovations on our villa are completed, you will be a welcome guest. Sunny blue skies and wonderful, wonderful climate and food and just about everything. John, thank you so much for that offer. It's very, very kind of you. Look, going back to France, though, I do understand that this is going to engender all kinds of feelings, but I don't think any of our feelings and thoughts and viewpoints about this can be fully formulated this close to the events themselves. It's rather like passing judgment on 9/11, right after 9/11. And from my memory, not a lot of people in the mainstream, I don't think anybody did that when those events were still raw. So that's where I'm coming to this from, and I hope you get that, and I hope you understand what I mean. Stuart in the UK says, I want to simply express my thanks and utter admiration. Stuart, thank you for the program that you work so hard to put out. I've been an avid listener for 3 years, love the content, always current, balanced and interesting, says Stuart. That's very, very kind of you, Stuart, and that gives me heart to carry on at those times when I just feel like I'm very depleted one way and another. Thank you. Susie, near Mount Shasta, I'm working on the suggestion that you made. Ralph Ellis, if it's the same Ralph Ellis, I did talk to on a very early edition of The Unexplained. We met face to face. Stephen in Edinburgh, great email, very thoughtful, good comments. Thank you. Dilly, new listener, hello, Dilly. And Kev in County Durham, northeast of England, good to hear from you. From Vince, says, love your show, which I listen to on my daily 100-kilometre commute from the Sunshine Coast to Brisbane, Australia. Wow. Well, I know part of that area, and I think you're very, very lucky to live there. Says, I love most of your guests, but I need to say this. One, I thought that James K. Lambert was annoying. I couldn't understand how he can dismiss so many concepts without real facts, especially 9/11. I loved Graham Hancock. The read, he's just bought his new book. The read is great so far, but his narration is below par. I have been spoiled by your voice. I think there was some criticism of Graham Hancock for being a little defensive by some listeners, but I've got to say, a great welter of support for Graham Hancock. A lot of you thought that he was fantastic to hear, and he isn't a man who is prone to doing every podcast and broadcast out there. He picks them very carefully, so I was glad to have him on, and I'd like to have him on again. A guest of great erudition, I thought, and you know, somebody who will always provoke intense reactions one way or the other. But often the best people do that. James Lawrence, also in Australia, says, I want to let you know about something I thought was a bit strange on your intro to edition 228. And I agree with you about this because the same fact dawned on me at the time that it dawned on you. In the intro to that edition, I was talking about shout-outs, and what I said was, I will go into a lot of your emails probably in the next edition unless something happens that means that I can't do that. Well, look, when you broadcast in the style that I broadcast, a lot of it is ad lib. And, you know, it's good, bad, or indifferent. You make the decision on that. And sometimes words come out of my mouth, and I don't realize that sometimes they are prophetic in some ways. Not that I'm a great prophet or sage or anything, which I am not. But it did strike me as being very odd that I did say that. And then, of course, the very next week we had these terrible events in France. James says, probably just a coincidence, but it made me wonder about the power of intuition, and our subconscious made me think too, James. Thank you very much indeed for your email. I think that's pretty much all of the emails that I can fit in for now. I'm sorry if you've emailed recently. I'm going to try and do a mega shout-out edition at some point where I have a lot of your thoughts. But thank you very much. And you do know that I see every single email as it comes in. Wherever I happen to be, I'm checking into email for The Unexplained constantly. And let me tell you, and I know I've told you before, and maybe I'm a bore about this, mainstream media doesn't do that. Mainstream media often just trashes the emails that you put in. And I mean literally puts them in the trash and doesn't really take account of them. That's not all mainstream media, but that is a certain amount. And how do I know? Because I've worked in it and I've seen it done. That's all I can say about that subject for right now. The guest on this edition is somebody who's been on the show a couple of times before, Tricia Robertson, after-death researcher, I guess you would call her, at a very high level in Scotland. She's a member of the Scottish Society for Psychical Research. Her last book, Things You Can Do When You're Dead, was very popular, sold a lot of copies, and we talked a lot about that. Some great stories in there, one or two of which you were captivated by and emailed me in great numbers about. We're going to talk with her about her current research and her second edition of that same book, Things You Can Do When You're Dead. We're going to cross to Glasgow to do that conversation in just a moment from now by digital connection, all being well. Just to say thank you very much for any donations that you made to The Unexplained. It's coming up to the end of the year, and it would be marvelous if it would be possible for you to make a donation to the show. If you've been enjoying it, then, you know, if you can't afford to make a donation, I've always understood that it can be a free product for you. But I have to survive too. So if it's possible, please, especially at this time of year, make a donation to The Unexplained. I'm not booked for broadcasting shifts across Christmas, so I'm going to give more attention to The Unexplained across that period and will announce to you my plans for the new year towards the end of this year. That's all I can say about that for now. If you want to make a donation to the show, please go to the website, theunexplained.tv. And thank you to Adam at Creative Hotspot again for his great work on this, as I've said. So it's theunexplained.tv. There, follow the PayPal link and you can leave a donation or send me any thoughts, any suggestions about the show. And please, when you do that, let me know who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. I love to know about you. I'm not profiling you or anything. I'm just getting an idea of the kind of people that when I open my mouth to record these shows, I'm speaking with. Let's cross to Scotland now, which I'm guessing is possibly even colder than London this morning. And let's talk with Tricia Robertson, researcher of some renown. Tricia, thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome.
Tricia, how's Glasgow? It's freezing cold, very bright here in London.
It's exactly the same here. Gorgeous sunshine. I'm overlooking the Campsie Hills, and it's beautiful but cold.
Yeah, well, your air is better than our air down here, though. I know that from having been there.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, lovely to have you on. I came up with a description for you, and I don't know whether it's going to infuriate or delight you, but I'll tell you. You are an afterlife and after-death researcher. Does that work?
Partly, that's part of it. I'm a psychical researcher, which investigates many things, including survival.
Okay, and you've been doing that. Let's remind people who haven't heard you before, you've been doing that for decades.
32 years.
Why did you start? I probably asked you this before, but, you know, for those new listeners, what is it that compelled you to do this?
The answer is, I have no idea. Not the answer you wanted, but I really don't know.
But listen, it's an answer I can completely understand, because it's the same with me. I started recording people years ago.
It was the best I can come up with was an intellectual interest, as I have no real religious belief before that at all. And it was just an intellectual interest. I had no unhappiness. There was nobody had died. And it was just an intellectual interest. And from that, it just grew and grew.
We all lose people as we get older. It is the way of life.
Yep.
Has your interest, you know, I know that you've lost people in your life. I have lost my dear parents and others from my life. Has your interest sharpened since then, or has it just continued as it was before?
Has it sharpened what exactly are you asking me? Has it sharpened what? My interest in survival?
Yes. Has it made your interest any more acute?
Not really. No, not really. Strangely enough, it makes the whole thing a bit better when you see the amount of evidence there is out there. Excuse me, I have a slight husky throat.
You're sounding
Carry
fine.
On.
You're sounding what the pair of them. What are we both like this morning? There's me deaf in one ear. You with a bad throat. Welcome to the Northern Hemisphere in the winter, Tricia.
Yeah, exactly. But
we're old troopers. Well, you're a young trooper. I'm an old trooper. We're old troopers. We'll carry on. Okay. Now, you say at the beginning of the latest edition of your book, Volume 2, which isn't out yet, we have to say that it's going to be out.
I have news for you, Howard.
You do? Okay. Update me.
I have just heard this minute that my book will be available from the 30th of November.
Really? That's very good. And is that internationally?
International. Amazon.com, Amazon UK, Kobo, all the usual suspects. Yep.
You sold a lot of copies of the first one and got some great reviews on Amazon. I've seen
great
them.
Reviews. Yes, I did.
So I guess you have high hopes for Volume 2.
I have indeed.
Things You Can Do When You Are Dead, which is the greatest title.
More things you can do.
It goes
a little bit deeper than the first book, and we look at deeper issues like cross correspondences, obsession, possession, more reincarnation, and the fascinating subject of automatic writing, which sounds completely boring, but it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating once you get into it.
I want to talk about that a little later in our conversation. I know somebody who can do that, so I'm, wow, you know, I'm almost pretty much convinced about automatic writing, but wow, more about that anon. Okay. At the top of the book, you say this book is written for people who do not know what to believe.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Well, a man in the street sees these dreadful television programs, radio programs, awful films that are made. They're made to make money. They scare the wits out of people, and that's being polite, and they have very little basis in reality. The reality is much calmer than that and much more joyous, shall we say. And I'm here to, remember, I have a maths and science, a physics background, and I like to keep everything rational, calm, logical. And that's the way I approach it, but it's still not boring. But I want to let people know that when they've lost their loved ones, well, that's one of the things I do, there is enough evidence to show that they will see them again. It's basically to give people in the street hope that there is evidence to show that their wishes are not in vain.
You talk to an extent in the book about the various ways that the departed make contact, we believe. Aromas, I've known that one myself.
Yeah.
Sounds, well, there are particular tunes that I hear at particularly poignant times, and I believe there's something there, but that's just me. Apparitions and messages on radio and TV. Talk to me about the ways we think the departed may be trying to get through.
Well, one of the most common one is the movement of objects within your house. It usually happens quite quickly after someone dies, or electrical interference. That's what happens to me when someone dies. It's been close to me. It's all electrical disturbances, things that cannot happen that happen. That's because I'm not at all mediumistic, and I'm psychically thick as a piece of wood. So the only way they can get through to me is electrically, or with sounds. Occasionally you can get a sound or a smell, like of your grandfather, tobacco smoke, something like that. But there are many, many ways that they can make themselves known. But the most common one is movement of objects, or feeling that your hair's being touched, or your cheek's being touched, or just a feeling of chill around you at an unexpected moment that's relevant to the person that's died.
There's one with me, and I don't understand how this works, but I certainly know what it means because it is infallible. It works every single time. Whenever I'm about to leave a place, and I've had a lot of jobs in this broadcasting industry, most people who are still around in broadcasting it just goes with the game, really. You know, you're constantly moving. Whether you are moving for your own reasons or you are moved, that's the way it is. I always hear, at the time when I'm about to move, a song being played by whichever radio station it happens to be. And that song is Randy Crawford's One Day I'll Fly Away.
Uh-huh.
And it happens invariably. I now laugh. I can be walking through the reception area, and this has happened many times. I can be walking through the reception area of the radio station that I am leaving that day, and the monitor speaker will be playing Randy Crawford's One Day I'll Fly Away. It is beyond coincidence.
And you just smile and laugh and say, thank you.
Yep, I do. In fact, the last time it happened, I did exactly that. I finished my shift, sat down in my car, turned on the radio. It was there the moment the radio came on. And I looked up and I just said, I know exactly what you mean. Thank you.
Yeah, that's it. Always say thank you. Yep. Great, super.
Yeah, no, I wish they'd come and talk to me, but, if we have to make do with a song on the radio, that's absolutely fine.
Well,
and,
perhaps you're as psychically thick as I am, yeah.
Well, you know what, Tricia? I would love to have a conversation with an apparition. I would love somebody to appear to me, but I do have belief, I think. And, one mustn't be too partisan about these things, otherwise you can't do a balanced conversation. But, too many things have happened in my life to make it beyond coincidence. I think there must be something. It's only a question of what the something is, and maybe we'll never quite have the wit to discern that, and we won't know the answers until we ourselves have gone.
I'm going to ask you a question. Do you actually think in reality, if someone appeared in front of you as an apparition and had a conversation, do you not think you would freak out?
I don't know. There is another way that this happens. And, you know, look, some listeners have said, we love it when you talk about your own experiences. More listeners have said that than have said the opposite. So here's what's happened to me this week. I've had a very busy week or so. I mean, filling in for somebody else, getting up at 3:30 in the morning, it's been pretty full on. So when I've gone to bed and slept, I've slept deeply. And I've dreamt. Now, I've lost my parents within the last decade, both of them, and I was very close to them. Most nights I've dreamt about them. And one morning, and I don't mind admitting this, one morning I woke straight out of the dream. You know, the alarm clock hadn't gone for 3:30. And I had been in their living room, and it was three-dimensional, full color. I was standing there, and there was a deathly silence there. You couldn't, there was nothing. No noise, no sound, no nothing. And two empty chairs. The two, they had identical armchairs at the end. And all there were photographs of my parents. Very clear photographs, colour photographs in life, all around that room. And the terrible, dulling sensation that they were not there.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was some kind of communication.
Not necessarily. It could just have been your dream, wishful, you know, wish fulfillment sort of thing. I couldn't say is the answer to that. I don't know. I wasn't there.
I'm sure the dreams are used. You know, after my mother died, I certainly, she appeared to me that evening and asked me if I was okay in a dream.
Great. Uh-huh. Well, that's probably more correct than what you're telling me about the second one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because really, when they pass, the first thing that they do is try to make sure that you're okay. Because when we grieve for people, we're actually grieving for ourselves. It's the loss of that person. They're absolutely fine. They are fantastic. I had the same with Professor Roy, as you know.
You worked with Archie Roy, probably the most famous researcher of this kind in Scotland.
And Archie died on a Thursday at tea time, and because of what I do, I keep a watchful eye on budding mediums, etc. I go to places where I can see people demonstrating, not necessarily people that even know me. And on the Sunday, I went to it wasn't a church, it was a sanctuary, to see a medium demonstrating. Now, Archie died was about tea time on a Thursday, and that was a Sunday morning. He came through clear as a bell with very relevant personal details that could only have been him. And the people in that sanctuary who knew me and had known Archie, everybody was in tears because it was just so fantastic.
Doesn't always work, though. You know, my father was a Liverpool policeman. He'd had experiences with ghosts when he'd been on duty that had terrified him, but he understood those things because he was always that way inclined. And his father had been psychic, and his father used to read the teacups, which people used to do in this country. And he, you know, his dad, who was a very level-headed man, used to do that. And I would have expected if anybody could have come through to me, it would have been my dad, and he hasn't.
There seems to be no rules or regulations regarding that. I've had people that have said to me, oh, I know I've got to come back to you, and people who understood, and they've never been back, and yet I get people through that you wouldn't expect. It's strange. I don't know what the rules are. No idea.
You talk about materialization in the book. It's one of the subject headings, and you have extensive quotes from somebody called Michael Rowe.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's not just Michael Rowe. I have a whole chapter on materialization with a variety of people who explain in detail their experiences in materialization circles. And the Michael Rowe one, Archie Roy himself actually sat in that same circle, not at the same time as Michael, a woman called Rita Gould, who doesn't do it anymore, down in the Midlands. And Rita was a very honest lady. People would go down, maybe just half a dozen at a time, and she would go into trance, and in the room, figures would materialize from ostensibly the ectoplasm coming from her body. They would stand up, formed into figures. They would talk to people. They would give information. And certainly a lot of it was done in the dark, but they were allowed to shine a red light from time to time when they were told they could shine the red torch. And Archie Roy, for example, will absolutely swear that he saw a little boy standing in front of him, and a little boy said to him, "See me wiggle my toes." And then Archie's hand was taken with the torch down to the toes, and sure enough, there were the tiny little toes of a little boy wiggling. And Michael Rowe, I would have to go back to read exactly what he told me again, but he had his father through. He didn't particularly believe it, the information given, everything that was given, and that changed his life around completely into the absolute knowledge that survival was a fact. I don't think it did him the world of good, because he's had to kick against the establishment ever since, as we all have, but we have to look at what actually happens. But there's so much material there about, if you pardon the pun, about materialization, that you cannot doubt that at least some of it has to be true. When one of the seances was in front of 200 people and they all saw the same thing.
And I'm glad that you say that you cannot doubt that at least some of it. We have to say there is a tremendous amount, and there has been back through history, of sheer fakery.
Oh, yeah. But you get fake coins. It doesn't mean all coins are fake.
You talk about Mary Armour, a medium. Her account of the session with a man that I knew and you knew, Colin Fry, a TV medium, very well known in the UK, sadly left us, died very young. I think he was 52 or 53 very recently. I liked Colin a lot. He used to come on my radio show.
Well, I knew Colin Fry 20 years ago, and so did Mary, obviously, long before he was the famous Colin Fry. He was just a lad, you know, 25 years ago, and Colin certainly developed his mediumship and made it very popular in the same sense that Patrick Moore made astronomy popular, although he wasn't actually a real astronomer, if you know what I mean. Mm. But he certainly popularized, and his heart was in the right place, absolutely.
You told me a story that I don't think has ever been written down, and I never broadcast it, but it made me laugh, because he was a very funny man, Colin. Yes. He told me a story after one show that I did with him on national radio in the UK about a traffic warden was about to give him a parking ticket. And, you know, sometimes traffic wardens can be a little brutal if you're just going back to your car. And they will nevertheless get you. We both know how that works.
No chance.
And Colin was deluged with information about this traffic warden. Some of it was not very complimentary towards him. And he told the story very funnily about how he was very tempted to feed back all of this information at this man who was giving him the ticket. But the story in the book about Colin Fry is about a materialization, the emergence of a personality called Dolly.
Well, Dolly, each materialization medium has a chief guide, as you want to call it that. It always sounds like Red Indians, but it's not that. And Dolly appeared to be the chief person that was in charge of Colin when he was doing his materialization. Now, Dolly was actually a transvestite and was a great personality and was really, you can imagine, hello, Dolly. Well, that was what Dolly was like. And Dolly would come through and give information and be sort of master or mistress of ceremonies of all that would go on to protect her own medium while he was in trance. That's what the guides do in materialization. They look after the welfare of the actual medium who's in trance. They're completely out of the game. They're not there.
You see, I was fascinated to read about Colin doing these things, because I always thought of Colin doing television shows where he'd stand in front of the audience like James Van Praagh does, or any of these people do, and call out a name and say, does this name mean anything to you? And then tell them some information. Yeah. And later they would be interviewed, the people you know, that he was pointing out in the audience, and they would say it was so accurate. I had no idea that he did all of this other stuff at appearances. There was much more to him than I knew.
There's much more to most mediums than you know. Gordon Smith will hate me for saying this, but Gordon in private circles does trance and materialization as well. And he's completely taken over in trance circles. A lot of mediums do that, but you have to be very protective of how and where you do that. And Colin did it for years. Colin, I think he sat in the Noah's Ark Society as well. I'm pretty sure in saying that, which they comb in on materialization and they try to develop that. Yes, in the Colin one that you're referring to, with Mary Armour, Mary Armour's daughter is a doctor, and they were told that during the seance that the doctor would be allowed to go and hold the arm of the materialised figure and take its pulse. So Mary's at a given time, she went forward and she took the pulse of the medium and the pulse of the materialised figure, and they were entirely different. Entirely different. And John Logie Baird had a session with another medium somewhere, I can't remember where, in which he took the fingerprints of the person, he, for some reason, he had the fingerprints of the character that was supposed to be coming through, and he took the fingerprints of the materialized figure, and when he checked them, they were identical. Mm. So here were the fingerprints of a deceased person coming through a materialized figure.
And this is John Logie Baird, very serious Scotsman, the man who invented television.
Yeah, there'll be no messing with John Logie Baird, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, he invented television, although his mechanical system ultimately wasn't the one that we use today, that we came to use, but he certainly pioneered it. A man of science he was, but he was also fascinated by all of this.
He was. He was, as were many eminent men of science. But even nowadays, you have to sort of curb your enthusiasm for it, or people look scancily at you. But that's changing, I think. That's changing. You've got people from the Max Planck Institute. You've got the likes of Brian Josephson. You have a lot of people, very, very clever people, who are looking at these things with an open mind, thank the Lord.
You have a section on drop-in communicators, and you reference a man I met when I was 23 years of old, maybe 24. I went to Nottingham to interview Alan Gould.
Yes, I know Alan. Alan's still with us, yep.
An amazing researcher into all of these things, a man with the most wonderful mellifluous voice as well.
Absolutely.
You know, he could tell any story to anybody at any time about anything and make it totally compelling. What are drop-in communicators?
Well, if people sit in a seance, in a private seance, looking for communication, some people do that week on week. They have little seances in their own house. And they're looking for their relatives and loved ones, but they're not looking for anyone they don't know. But occasionally, on occasion, people come through and give such a lot of information about themselves that these people can subsequently be found. They can be traced to have lived. Now, Alan Gould, he became heir to a whole pile of transcripts from a circle that sat, in the 1960s, 70s, I think it was. Now, I don't think Alan particularly wanted this huge box of transcripts, but to his credit, he started to look through them. And he realized that there were quite a large number of people coming through and giving vast amount of information about themselves that no one in the circle knew. The medium didn't know that person. And yet it looked as if these people had existed. So Alan Gould, in his wisdom, and great praise be to him, he took the time to actually go and research these characters. And he found the great majority of them had lived, and the information given with such specifics were absolutely true. Now, where did that information come from? It couldn't have come from the medium. They didn't know the person. It couldn't have come from the sitters. They didn't want them at all. And to my mind, if it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
I remember sitting in his office at Nottingham University, and I was very young and very trepidatious about this, with one of those great big Ewer reel-to-reel tape recorders, which we all had to use in those days. And they would record 15 or 20 minutes at a time. Then you'd have to change reels. Mm-hmm. But he impressed upon me something that I had no idea about at the time, that, as you say, this is the gold standard of communication. If it is material that has not been known and could not be known by the medium, then you're onto something of a completely different order.
To me, it is one of the gold standards. Yes, it is indeed. Excuse me, croaky throat again. Yes,
you're doing brilliantly, by the way.
Well, thank you very much.
Be kidding.
Alan is what I call a fastidious, steadfast researcher. He would do the work slowly, carefully, and in the second book. Well, I'm not going to talk about it because it's in the book. The case of Harry Stockbridge, for example, is amazing, where the communicator came through, gave such a lot of detail about himself, and he gave his date of death. Now, when Alan checked up the War Memorial had the day, it was either the day before or the day after for Harry Stockbridge's death. So Alan researched in the War Office, he wrote to the government, he wrote to platoons, he wrote everywhere, and he found out eventually that the communicator was correct. The date given in the circle was the actual date of the death.
For our listeners, who was Harry Stockbridge?
Oh, it doesn't matter. He was just a soldier in a platoon. during the Second World War. That doesn't really matter. The point is, the information this person gave was not easily checked up upon, and yet after months and months of searching and writing to War Office and Home Office, all the rest of it, Alan found the communicator was absolutely correct. Now, no one in that circle had an interest in Harry Stockbridge. They couldn't have cared less about Harry Stockbridge. They wanted Auntie Jeannie and Uncle Willie and their mother and the father. So where does that, you've got to ask yourself the question, where does the information come from?
And a truly remarkable case in that it pointed up an anomaly in the retained information.
Correct.
Which correct. Is, how do you begin to explain that? You can't, apart from saying that it is what it appears to be.
Well, you'll hear people naming no names who will trot out the expression super ESP. What the hell does that mean? Nothing. It means that you're tapping in somewhere to this information. Now, this information is not easily accessed. It had to be found from various sources to check that that was absolutely correct. And that is the case with a lot of other ones as well. So as I said before, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck to me. And the most parsimonious explanation, as in Occam's razor, is the personality has survived and is passing that information back down to people here. Now, Stockbridge wouldn't know anyone in that circle, but it was obviously his only means of communication to get the information through.
This is a good point to bring in something that comes towards the end of your new book, and that is the whole topic of resistance to the acceptance of survival after death. In other words, we know much more about this, and there is much more evidence coming out. But it seems also that that counter to that, the opposition, the refusal to accept it, the putting your fingers in your ears and going da-da-da-da-da, is increasing.
Yep. Well, I think it's getting better. And this is one of the reasons, actually, that I have written these books. I didn't really set out to write books, but as you know, Professor Roy and I gave lectures at Glasgow University, adult education, for many years. And when Archie died, I thought, you know, the best way to memorialise this is to put a lot of our work, and some new work, of course, into books. Because everybody that came to the university absolutely loved the 40 hours of lectures, loved them. And so I've incorporated some of the essence of those within the two books. But as Stanley Krippner said, you know, you'll either love the book or hate the book, but you certainly won't be bored by it. And that's absolutely true. But, I mean, there's so many other ways of looking at information. For example, I don't know if you know about the Bang sisters that were psychic artists.
I read something a while back, yes.
Well, I mean, once again, I'll tell you about this because it once again looks like a duck. The Bang sisters were actually physical mediums more than psychic artists, although they did use artistic material. And the first recorded demonstration of their, what they call precipitated art, because what would happen was a canvas would be put on somewhere, and underneath the canvas there would be little oil paints at the bottom. The whole canvas would then be covered by a cloth. You as a sitter would come in and sit beside the mediums, the Bang sisters. It would sit for an unspecified time, and when the canvas was lifted, there would be a picture of your loved one there. And if you didn't like it, and if you said, oh, I didn't really want them to have those pearls on, they would cover the canvas again after an unspecified time, lift the cloth, and the pearls would be gone. Now, they never touched anything. But even more interesting to me, and much more evidential from my point of view and your point of view, Vice Admiral William Osborne Moore was Queen Victoria's cartographer, and he diligently investigated the Bang sisters. Now, as a cartographer, he was a keen observer, as you can imagine, and kept immaculate records. Now, he saw the works of the Bang sisters. I think they came to England, actually. And he saw them, and he devised a test for them. So after seeing the works of the sisters, he contacted Sir William Crookes, whom, as you know, was a chemist, and he asked him to prepare an ink which incorporated ingredients not normally associated with ink. Because one of the other things the Bang sisters did was, you could go to the Bang sisters, Howard's going to the Bang sisters, with an envelope with a blank sheet of paper in it. You sit with a sealed envelope in front of the Bang sisters, you don't move, they don't move, And as you're sitting there now, in those days they had the little bottles of ink. You might remember from your school days, a little bottle of ink, and you had to put a pen in it.
Yes, I remember those quink bottles of ink.
That's the very chap, right? So you can sit there, Howard Hughes is there, the Bang Sisters is there, there's an envelope with nothing on it, and a bottle of your quink ink at the side with a pen in it, or not, it doesn't really matter. As you sit there for an unspecified time, everyone in the room can hear scratching noises coming from the inside of the envelope, as if a nib was writing on paper.
Good Lord.
And after that time, you, Howard Hughes, open the envelope, and there is written in the handwriting of your loved one is a message for you, signed by them. So Osborne Moore thought, I'm going to test this. So he had William Crookes make up an ink that was a one-off ink with ingredients in it that were not normally in ink. So he subsequently presented himself to the Bang Sisters along with the sealed envelope and his own bottle of Crookes' special ink. And the Bang Sisters said, yes, that should not be a problem. Now, what happened then was exactly the same as before. Osborne Moore sat there, and the other interesting thing was the little bottle of ink that you could see, as you heard the scratching on the paper, the level of the ink would diminish.
Oh.
If it was 2 inches high, you would see it slowly going down to 1 inch. So this happened again.
What, just as if the same thing would happen if there was a leak in the bottle?
Yeah.
It was going down like that. Wow.
In front of your eyes while the scratching was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So the usual routine took place. A handwritten letter was given to Osborne Moore. Osborne Moore then sent the letter to William Crookes for analysis, and Crookes confirmed that the ink in the letter was the ink that he had prepared.
I don't know what to say about that. But look, if this is possible, why is nobody doing this now?
Well, we don't know. Why are these things not worldwide known from the time it happened, in the time of the early 20th century? Why do we all not know this? As the same reason as why do we all not know the likes of the work of Chico Xavier with the automatic writing?
I'm glad you got to Chico Xavier and the automatic writing, because that is fascinating, isn't it? There
Absolutely.
Are people who are doing that now. In fact, it seems there's not as much of this stuff on television now, but back in the days of great talk show hosts like David Frost, this kind of thing used to be on mainstream television, which it is not now. Automatic writing, though, I've actually experienced this with a guy called Christian Dion, a British medium who now lives in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And he can do it, two hands, and he can, without looking at the paper particularly,
yep.
And he can write coherent sentences that come out, and I still have no idea how that is done or quite what it is.
Well, the theory, if we take one theory, obviously, in his case, two people are working through him at the same time. So one's writing with the right hand and one's writing with the left hand. And this is quite common. Chico used to do that too. And diversing slightly, one of the healers, I think it was Arrigo, used to write prescriptions for people with two hands, two different prescriptions at the same time, and quite often in a different handwriting. Now, back to Chico Xavier. Yes, some people still can do it, but Chico was amazing. I mean, this man was only educated to primary six, we would call it. And yet, in 2010, he was voted Brazilian's Personality of the Year, and his photograph went on a stamp. Why? Because he did so much work with automatic writing. He wrote, I'm just getting facts and figures, he wrote 259 poems by 56 different poets, including almost every leading figure from Brazilian Portuguese poetry. And he was tested in a laboratory for his brain waves, so that he was interested in what was going on, because he didn't understand it either. And the incognito and double blind testing, they sent Chico's brain waves and the brain waves of Chico while he was doing automatic writing to a laboratory, obviously disguised it, double blind testing. And the scientists said there is no way that these two brain waves could come from the same person, which makes you think someone else's brain waves, personality, energy, whatever you want to call it, is the one doing the writing.
Mm. And this also happens with music, doesn't it?
It does indeed. That's another, I've got a bit about that as well, but that's too long to go into. Now, there was another man, another Brazilian man, a scientist called Hermani Andrade. Now, he takes an altogether more cerebral approach to survival. It's very upmarket, very clever, very scientific, quite difficult at times, but Andrade is a wonderful afterlife researcher as well. So just after one of Chico's books was published, an admirer of Chico brought him a copy of Andrade's book, and he said to Chico, "What did you think of Andrade's book?" And Chico looked at him and said, "How would I know?" He said, "I don't even understand my own." And that's absolutely true. Now, Chico's output were millions and millions of pounds worth, or the currency worth of stuff, and he never took a penny for himself. He gave all of the money from automatic writing to the local community, for hospitals, schools, and to the local community. And that is why the populace voted for him to be personality of the century, against the government's wishes, actually. They didn't want that. They wanted Pele or one of the presidents to be on the stamp. But no, the people insisted it was Chico Xavier. Mm. What a fantastic man.
Sometimes an embarrassment, isn't it, for the powers that be when the people speak?
Well, yeah, we'll not go any further than that one, yeah.
Here's a story about Christian Dion that I've never told on this show, or indeed anywhere else. In fact, I'd forgotten until right now, until this moment. This is absolutely true. Christian Dion, British medium, now in Los Angeles, likes to do a lot of celebrity showbiz psychic gossip. That's his thing. A very flamboyant character, trained as an actor, very interesting person. You know, he would do readings. I'd listen to him on radio doing readings, and he'd say, "You know, you've been through a bloody terrible time. It's been like you've been through a long, dark tunnel, but I'm telling you now, it's going to be okay." So he's a psychic medium, and I've always believed he had something for reasons that I'll go into on another show, but he certainly did some work with me that I can't explain and came out to be right. Automatic writing, he said he did it. So he demonstrated in my parents' home in Freshfield near Southport in about 1984, this was, maybe 83. I was very, very young, very new to researching all of this stuff. So Christian is there and he starts to write. And next door is a man called Brian Hurdle, who still lives in the same house next to my late parents' house. And Brian... I didn't know much about it, to tell you the truth, and I knew nothing about it until this moment. Had a background in the RAF. Now, Christian automatically wrote down a lot of stuff about the RAF, about Spitfires. Those were the famous World War II British planes, for listeners in America. I'm sure you know what they are. And about certain events that happened. And sealed the letter, which I later passed to Brian. And Brian confirmed the stuff in it was correct. And we didn't know where it had come. I think there was also mention of somebody who perhaps had died and had been a colleague of Brian. It's a long time ago. I would need to talk to Brian, who's still alive. God bless him, up in Freshfield. And I will talk to Brian about that. But he was quite staggered by it. Absolutely staggered by it. And from that day to this, I've never talked about that. And I still don't understand what was going on.
Well, once again, you have to ask yourself, where did that information come from?
I have not the faintest idea. I mean, Christian hadn't even met Brian next door.
Well, I'm still asking you the question, where possibly could that information have come from?
Yeah, I mean, where could it have come from? Well, it could have come from colleagues of people who worked with Brian in the RAF during World War II. It could have been some kind of telepathy between the walls of the two houses with a person that Christian had never met. Whatever it was pretty damn remarkable.
I think that's very unlikely, the telepathy answer, very unlikely. The most parsimonious answer is that whoever was writing it was trying to get information through to Brian. Surely that's the most parsimonious answer.
That's what I've always thought about this. But listen, I haven't even thought about that for easily 10 years, probably more. And just the mention of automatic writing brought that true event. And I swear that happened in my dear parents' home. On a Sunday afternoon, very near Easter.
Fantastic. That's a tremendous experience for you to have.
30 years ago. But, that's something that maybe if I ever write a book, I'm going to put in it. But
amazing.
The guy's amazing. I'm going to have him back on this show. He's still doing his work.
You were talking Sorry, yes,
you were saying.
You were talking about a materialization.
Yes.
And people have sort of said to me, well, where do you go from here? You know, I have three published papers on mental mediumship, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel I've been drawn towards physical mediumship. And I did sit in a materialization circle fairly recently. And I have to say that amongst all the other things, there were definitely things there that I could not explain. I've tried to rationalize it out. I could not explain the things that happened in that circle. And that, I think, is the way I'd like to go, is to sit in more physical circles and just see what's what. As long as I can put in my own protocols, then I'll be happier than with the last one I was in. But even at that, there were things I could not explain because I have no imagination. I'm not artistic. I'm not a medium. I don't have a fanciful type of mind. But there were things there that I saw and felt that I could not explain. Quite fantastic.
Well, you've teased my listener. Just can you give me one example?
Well, it sounds crazy unless you were there. I was invited to this circle and I was sitting beside people I didn't know at that time at all. There's a woman on my left called Pauline and a girl called Alice on my other side. And you have to sit in a physical circle. You all have to hold hands the whole time. And my downside is it was all done in the dark, which I really don't like. But there was a point a red light was put on, but not long enough for me, but that's a different matter. And the reason you have to hold hands and put your knees together is to make sure the person next to you is not moving. There's no one moving around. Now, it's quite a small space. Relatively, it's not a big space, maybe 9 by 9 or something like that. Not a big space at all. And there was the usual rappings and tappings and things allegedly flying about, which didn't particularly impress me. And then I heard someone, I did know someone who was sitting further down, and I heard her going, oh my God. And at that, a light appeared like a ball. It was like, it wasn't solid, so it wasn't a solid thing. This ball of light came past Helen, and I heard her saying, oh my God, look at the fingers. And as the light came round, and it wasn't just on the one level, it was going up and down. And as it passed me, I was determined to be watching what was in this ball. And as the ball passed me, I could see it was as if it was being held in a little tiny hand. And you could see through the ball. And it wasn't solid. There was a little filaments inside it. It was so delicate. And as it passed me, I mentally said, oh, don't go so quickly. Come back, come back. And it stopped and it came back to let me. I'd only thought it, and it came back to let me see inside it. And then the woman next to me saw it as well. And of course, I said to her, what did you see? And we all saw the same thing at a different time, at a different level. That was one thing I could not explain. So the next day I was on the computer looking at holograms, etc. And there's nothing fits that parameter whatever. But there was lots of other things happened to other people as well. And there was another a thing to do with light that I saw another figure coming round, and I could see the skeleton through the actual figure. I could see it was like an X-ray. As it passed me, I was sitting in a corner. There's lots of interesting things. I would love to do it again. I'd love to be more awake, alert to possibilities, but I would love to do it again. I think it's fascinating.
It seems that the golden age of all of this was from perhaps the turn of the century and up and to and through World War II. I say this for a reason. One of those interviews that I did, age 23, and I've mentioned her before, was with a grammar school. I believe she was a deputy headmistress. She'd been my sister's deputy headmistress. A very, well, as people were of that time, I interviewed her, as I say, early to mid-80s. Lola McNaught is her name. And we played a little audio clip of her a couple of years back on the show from that original interview from when I was 23. She talked about the great era in Liverpool of the physical mediums, the people who made, in one case, a little girl appear, or was it a little boy, who came round and touched people in the circle. And Lola, I looked into her eye as I did this interview, and I was, only 23, sitting there in her front room in Waterloo in Liverpool. And, you know, she was completely convincing and totally believable. She said this little person who appeared came round and touched people on the hand. What could that have been?
Well, we were certainly touched. We were certainly touched in that circle as well. And the chairs were all jammed in close together. And at one point, it was impossible for the chairs to move because we were jammed from wall to wall. And at one point, we all felt as if, pardon me, the chairs were being pushed along the line, and we were touched by a hand as well.
But equally, a phrase that I've never forgotten from Alan Gould in his wonderful, lugubrious British voice, the way he said, I personally have seen cases of the most egregious fakery. There has been in physical mediumship egregious fakery.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure there's fakery in everything. And also in modern mediumship, there's a lot of delusion as well. And all mediumship is not equal, unfortunately. And this is a whole problem. There are gold standard people, you know, people are fantastic. And they're few and far between, I have to tell you. And there's some people that are just downright awful, to be honest with you. And some of the awful ones are making a lot of money. I will not go into that.
True enough. You have a tantalising little section about help from beyond. In my case, whenever I'm going to do something big in London, I don't do quite as much of that kind in London anymore, but whenever I do, I try and go to the Church of All Souls, which is next to Broadcasting House. It's the Broadcasting Chapel. It's part of the BBC. And I sit there in the pews and I try, please don't laugh, and I hope my listeners will understand, and connect with a man called Ray Moore. He was a broadcaster on BBC Radio 2. He's from the same town, went to the same school that I went to, had a marvellous voice. I was a big fan of Ray. Incredibly funny man. His funeral, his service was there at All Souls Broadcasting House. So even right up to today, if I'm going to do, for example, I had some sessions to do for Britain's Radio Academy, where I have to stand and present to broadcasters about whatever topic it might be. Mm-hmm. I would go and sit in the chapel at All Souls there, the BBC's chapel, the Broadcasting Chapel, and ask Ray for help. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I always believe that he did.
Not ridiculous at all.
I believe that Ray helped me.
It's not at all ridiculous.
Maybe it's just the ramblings of an old fool, but I think there's something in it.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know yourself, if you're standing up, I know if I'm lecturing, I don't speak the same way I'm speaking to you just now. You stand up and you adopt a different persona. It's as if there's someone there helping you, even if it's just to make the best of yourself. No, it's not foolish at all, not in the slightest.
And I do believe, to an extent, and I am a level-headed person, and I am a journalist, and will ask the hard questions of whoever has to be interviewed, but there have been occasions when I really haven't known how it's been possible to do a thing. Two occasions in my own life, I used to do the live voiceover and commentary on a huge television show called the British Comedy Awards. I did it for 8 years. And thinking about it now scares me, because it was all live and it had to be perfect, and it always was, and I would come out of it and say, I didn't do that. Another occasion where I'm sure I was helped was I had to do, to cover the Queen Mother's funeral service, which was a massive national event because, as you remember, she was such a loved and respected person.
Yes.
I had to cover that for all of the stations that were then owned by London's Capital Radio. And that was a lot of stations up and down the country. I had to do it all by myself and mix the audio from it, do it all in a timely and appropriate way, and above all, do it to time and not make any mistakes.
And
now, thinking of that makes me feel sick. But I did it, and I finished it on time for all of the stations, and everybody said, wow. And I looked around and I said, well, I am convinced I did not do that. You know, I don't think I have that ability, but it somehow came through me. I'll never understand it.
Well, you did it, and that was great. It's like even writing a book, you go back and you read it, you know, months later, or you read and you think, I don't remember writing that. But obviously you did write it, but it's as if someone else is doing it for you. But of course, it's my own material.
You cover reincarnation in the book.
The first book has got more reincarnation than the second one. The second, there's actually quite a good program from America, Don't Laugh, on just now in one of the other channels, in which they're covering a lot of the cases that Jim Tucker deals with in his book, Return to Life. Now, Jim Tucker is from the University of Virginia, worked with Professor Ian Stevenson, etc., as you know, and they have logically and systematically investigated about over 3,000 cases of ostensible reincarnation of children who remember a previous life. Now, some people are not going to like what I'm going to say. The cases of reincarnation which appear after regression, I don't give the same amount of weight to. I like the cases where children can speak of a previous life from the minute they can actually speak. And this, it's called The Ghost Within My Child, and it's a series that's on Lifetime just now on television, and they're actually doing it very, very well. And they show you the children, and it's cases, verified cases of children who, from when they could speak, could give their name, how they died, etc., etc., from a previous life. And often these children are not happy children. And often, as in my case in my first book, the Cameron case, they'll say to their mum, "I've got another mum. You're not my mum. Someone else is my mum," and they'll give details. Now, on this program, they've done it really well, and they've taken the children back to the place where they think they died, and they do a little service, like a goodbye service to the first personality. And you know, it's amazing how that seems to work. But the amount of detail that these children can provide is unbelievable. Some of them are very unhappy memories, and some are quite happy memories, and some are somewhere in between. But along with the 3,000 cases in the America, the case that I did with Cameron is very similar in the way the child speaks to the mother. And there's this coherence all over the world with any child that remembers a previous life. It's quite fascinating.
And every so often, something happens in both our lives, I'm sure, Tricia, that will shake you. And I know that some of my listeners will say he's telling another story again. And I'm sorry for that. It's just because I've lived a few years and you and I have both got stories to tell. But, you know,
we have.
I may be a deluded fool, but I remember working.
I don't think you are.
Well, you know, I might be. It's still open to debate. Who knows? And, you know, frankly, we've just got to press on with life. I don't know. But look, I was filling in for Pete Price on Radio City, who's a big talk show host in Liverpool. And I went back to my home city and I stayed in my dear late dad's house with him. And we had a lovely time together. It was probably 2009 or so. And my mother had died in 2006. One day I was going into work on the Merseyrail train from Freshfield or Formby station into Liverpool. And there is the most delightful little girl sitting opposite me. And just as I would have imagined my mother to have been when she was little, she told me so many stories about her Liverpool childhood. It was a magical and very innocent time. She was the most delightful little girl with her big brother, who must have been a teenager. And this girl was maybe four. And she looked up at me and she just said with an innocent smile, "Where are you going then?" And I said, "I'm going into work." She looked at my jeans and she said, "You can't go into work wearing those." And I thought, that's exactly the kind of thing my mum would have said. And I just thought, you are captivating. And then the clincher for me was, and I said, "What's your name?" And she told me her first name. She said, my name is Hughes.
Oh.
That's my name, you know. And wow. I tell you what, I was smiling, but I was nearly crying then because I thought, look, probably nothing. But if my mum had come back, that's what she'd have been.
No,
so there you go.
You can't go like that. I used to laugh. This is off topic a bit, but you know, I've done a few television documentaries for BBC and Channel 4, etc. And my mother was someone who couldn't quite get to grips with this because she couldn't understand how all these people could be up there. There was no room for them. God bless her. But I would do a documentary and I would go into her maybe the next day and sit down. Now, no word was mentioned of the documentary, nothing. And then eventually she would say, "I watched your program last night," and I would just go, "Oh," and then she would say, "Why did you wear that blouse?"
Oh.
That was the amount of applause I would get. "Why did you do this? Why did you do that?" But God bless her. After she was getting there, before she died, she was beginning to think, "Yeah, there's maybe something in this." So that was really quite good. Yeah. Mm.
There is so much that we could talk about and so much we could say. And I hope my listeners will forgive me for telling my stories and for for having a conversation with you, which is what we've done. So, you know,
that's
it hasn't been a
do.
Forensic examination, but you no, and I just talked, don't we?
Very quickly, mm-hmm. Just put in two lines.
Please
of
do.
Patience Worth from the automatic writing. Patience Worth was a personality who worked through an American lady called Mrs. Curran. Now, Mrs. Curran was only educated up to the age of 14, with not a great education. But she did sit in circle every week, and she developed this personality coming through her called Patience Worth. Now, people might think it was a figment of her imagination, except for the fact that Patience Worth wrote in Old English. And Patience Worth, the study of Patience Worth is absolutely fantastic, the amount of output that's come from that. Through Mrs. Curran, fairly uneducated lady, there were four novels produced: The Sorry Tale, Tecla, Hope True Blood, and The Pot Upon the Wheel. The output of that was tremendous. Now, Dr. Walter Franklin Pierce came to see Mrs. Curran do the work with patients in trance. And Dr. Franklin Pierce thought that it was a lot of nonsense. And after questioning the patient's personality through Mrs. Curran, he said to her, "You're a conscious subconscious dream of Mrs. Curran's." And patients would say in Old English, "And what be thee, sir? Nay, egad, thee are a sorry dream over too much curd." And patients, his quick-witted reports were just that, came back in a fraction of a second. Everything he said, she would have an answer to in Old English, in the correct syntax. Mrs. Curran was American, from Boston, didn't have it. And Prince said to patients, "Part of the odd words you use, she unconsciously remembers or she has invented." And patients says, "Well, it be a trick, can they do it?" And then the very, very final one I want to share with you, because I think it's fantastic, is after 5 years of examining Mrs. Curran and patients coming through, Prince, with no warning, asked patients to write lines beginning with every letter of the alphabet, A, B, C, D, except X, and to write something about them in the correct order. The reply came fully in alphabetical order, minus the X, at a speed which was even difficult to take down for the shorthand person who was there. But as Prince himself dryly remarked, her opinion of the task to which she was set was evident from the last two lines. She looked, through Mrs. Curran, she looked at Prince, and the last two lines were with the letters Y and Z. And the lines were, "Yea, this thy servant upon the path of folly, zealously endeavouring to follow, that she follow a fool." And he said, that's what she thought of him. And Prince eventually had to reluctantly give in that the works coming through Patience Worth were definitely not coming from the subconscious mind of Mrs. Curran. He didn't want to do that, but he had to, because, as I say, it's all about the evidence. The evidence is there. In all of the things we've been talking about, there is a huge amount of evidence. And this short time, of course, gives us no time to go into all of it. But believe me, the evidence is there. Don't be disheartened. Look in the right places and you'll find evidence for survival amongst other paranormal phenomena.
Tricia, I'm really pleased you have a publication date finally for the new book. It's called More Things You Can Do When You're Dead. It's effectively, if I can even say the word, a volume two, published on November the 30th. What's the publisher?
White Crow Books.
It's White Crow. We know them well. If people want to know about you and your work, is there a place online they can go?
Yes, they can go to my website. It's www.trisharobertson, spelled T-R-I-C-I-A, trisharobertson.weebly.com, W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. So the Trisha is spelled with T-R-I-C-I-A, robertson.weebly.com. And there's a whole bit about my research into healing, etc., a whole lot of stuff with references. Now, I should say that in both books, I give you my side of the story, I give you the evidence, but I also provide you with masses of references where you can go and find out more about what I'm saying. My book is written for the man in the street, the woman in the street who does not know where to go for credible information. But surprising to me, Howard, is the bigwigs, you know, the Bernard Carrs, John Poynton's, all the people who know about psychical research, they all love it as well. They love it because it's simple, it's straightforward. I don't mince my words, as you know, and they just love it. And it gives people the opportunity to take any subject further if they want to, because everyone's not at the same stage to accept things at the same time.
I got a lot of response to you and your appearance on the last time that you came on here.
All right.
The one story that captivated people more than anything else, and we don't have time to go in detail into that, but it's in our previous show about the first book, was the story of the airline pilot. I know Glasgow Airport well.
Yeah.
The airline pilot who turns up for work at Glasgow Airport and has a conversation with a colleague who he later discovers had died.
3 days earlier, in Edinburgh.
Yeah, and I got a lot of response to that.
But he didn't know the guy had died. He hadn't seen him for a year. And it turned out at Glasgow Airport that the coffin was coming from Edinburgh through Glasgow Airport to the plane to Stornoway, in which the chap lived that had just died.
Yeah.
And it didn't do my Captain Bob any good at all, because he was an agnostic and he really didn't like the idea, because he said, I bloody well know who I spoke to, because they had a relevant conversation.
What can you say about that?
And there was other corroborating evidence as well, like the weight loss we'll not go into just now. But that was fascinating. And what fascinated me more was I went up to the chief of security with Bob to Glasgow Airport, and the chief of security took us seriously. He absolutely took us seriously, which I thought was fantastic.
But hadn't they mysteriously lost the video camera footage from that day?
Because that was pre the time that the people drove their car into Glasgow Airport. They only kept the video footage for a week, and by the time Bob got to me, it was over that time, and the video footage had been wiped, and it was reused again.
What a shame. See, what a great story.
Well, nowadays with digital, probably that wouldn't happen. It would always be there, you know. But that was 1996.
Tricia, great success with the book. I love talking with you. We'll talk again, and thank you very much.
And
I hope the throat gets better. We've been a pair of pair of sufferers today, haven't we?
Old crocs. Yeah. Lovely to talk to you.
You with your throat
thank
and me
you.
With my ear. Thank you very much, Tricia. Please take care.
Bye.
The great Tricia Robertson in Scotland, and the book that she talked about will be out very soon. Please watch this space, but search her name and details will appear, I am sure. And I'll put a link to her and her work on my website, theunexplained.tv, which is designed, created, honed and maintained by Adam at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. You know, in 2016, The Unexplained will be online, at least a decade old. It's already more than that, if you take into account the radio show that came before the online version. Big plans for 2016. Thank you very much for being with me, as you have been every step of the way. If you've got anything to say about the show, any suggestions for it, I see all of your emails. Please get in touch via the website, theunexplained.tv, and if you can possibly make a donation, especially at this time of year, please do. You can do that through the website, theunexplained.tv, and follow the simple and safe PayPal link. Until next we meet here, please stay safe, please stay calm, and please stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. I am in London, and this has been The Unexplained. Bye-bye.